I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. It's hard enough to keep your kids away from the Xbox on a normal weekday. It must be even tougher when they're home from school for a full week. But technology might just help this time around. Perhaps you can even convince your child to turn off the video game and pick up a Kindle or a Nook or an iPad and dig deep into a great story. You've probably heard by now that reading is good for your kids, and the winter break might just be a great excuse to reinforce studies of the same sort. Today, three Johnson County librarians back us up on this theory and share some of their favorite reads of 2011 for kids of all ages. This hour, picture books, fantasy fiction, historical graphic novels, and much more. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, every Christmas season we get together with our buds at the Johnson County Library to talk about good kids' books to consider for gifts. This year is no exception, and we're going to spice our conversation this morning by visiting with a real, honest-to-goodness author, Andrea Warren, who lives in Prairie Village. She's written a new book, Charles Dickens and the Street Children of London. This is a story of how Charles Dickens developed his affinity for the poor, and that was an affinity that led him to portray the poor in his many books as the worthy people he knew them to be. So first this morning, some introductions. Andrea Warden, good morning. Nice to have you, Andrea. Nice to have you.
Hi, Steve. Nice to be here.
And back with us again from the Johnson County Public Library, Debbie McLeod, the youth collection specialist who's on the very brink of retirement. Debbie, congratulations.
Oh.
Always good, Steve. To have you here.
Yeah, I'll still be around.
That's good. Kate Pickett's also here. She's the young adult librarian. Kate, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
And Dennis Ross is here. He's the youth specialist from the Central Library in Johnson County. Dennis, happy holidays to you, too.
Good morning.
Well, Andrea, let's start with your new book on Charles Dickens. I mean, there is a pivot point in his young life, in young Charles Dickens' life, where at age 12, he is sent off to work at Warren's blacking factory, of all places.
No relation.
Yeah. Well, why was this such a jolt to him to go there, Andrea?
Well, what it did was it took him from being a middle-class boy into being a working-class boy. Mm-hmm. And the significance of that is that Dickens had been taught that the lower classes were diseased, that they were unworthy, that they deserved being in that station in life, and that they shouldn't aspire to anything better. And what he found out was that they were people just like him. He was working with boys his age, and they had the same aspirations and goals and actually were kind to him. In fact, the kindest of all was a large orphan boy named Bob Fagin, of all things. Dickens later borrowed his name for one of his most villainous of villains.
Well, Dickens, for sure, did not want to be there.
Absolutely not.
In the blacking factory, right?
The family had sunk into debt. His father had been raised on a mansion with a wealthy family. His parents were servants, but he had seen all this life, and he wanted it for himself, and he always pretended to be above his station. So he would dress like a gentleman, and he would spend like a gentleman, too, but he actually was a naval pay clerk, so that would have kept his family solidly in the middle class, but he was constantly in debt. That finally caught up with the family, and he was thrown into debtor's prison. And you don't get out of debtor's prison until your debts are paid, one of those ironies of life. And Dickens' mother and three younger siblings went to live with the father in prison because their only alternative was to move into the workhouse. Dickens worked in this factory and took care of himself. He lived in a children's boarding house.
What got made at Warren's blacking factory? What happened there?
Well, they made boot black. And, you know,
like
a bottle,
stuff.
Like exactly, mm-hmm. that you put on your shoes and your boots. And as children's labor goes, it wasn't that bad a job. But it was 10 hours a day, 6 days a week for very, very low wages. And this factory sat right on the edge of the Thames River. It was cold in winter. It was hot in summer. There were rats everywhere.
And tell us about the rats, because you described them so well in the book. Dickens was just completely grossed out by all the rats.
He was indeed, because he had never lived like that. I mean, his family had again, been solidly middle class. They had a char girl who lived with them, who'd come out of a workhouse, who did all that hard labor. So this was a real change in circumstances for him.
Wow. What impact did this job have on him, Andrea?
Well, what it did, it went into him at such a deep level that he never recovered from it. So years later, he could be walking the streets of London, and if he'd come across one of the streets he'd taken to work, the factory was eventually torn down, but it would just all come flooding back, that feeling of insecurity, of having no power, of having no money, of having to labor long and hard, of never knowing what his future was. And he desperately wanted an education. Well, if you're working 6 days a week in a bootblack factory, you're not going to school. School costs money. His parents didn't have the money to pay his tuition. He actually had very little formal education. One thinks from reading him that he probably went to Oxford, but in truth, he had only several years of schooling, and he was a self-educated man. Hmm. He got his training to be a writer through journalism. He rose to the ranks as a court reporter.
There's hope for us. Yeah.
Absolutely, because he became a political reporter, and he went out traveling throughout England and got to know the people, the politics, the circumstances of their lives. This is when he really saw child labor, getting into those huge factories in Birmingham, Manchester, and seeing what life truly was like for working children. I mean, he'd seen it in London too, but not on quite the scale of the factories that he saw there. And he was horrified by it, and he really wanted to do something about it.
We're visiting with Andrea Warren of Prairie Village about her new book, Charles Dickens and the Street Children of London. And we should point out, this book is for kids.
It is. It's for readers 8 and up.
Okay.
Yes.
And how do they take to it? What's been your reaction so far?
Well, the book's brand new, but initial reaction is wonderful.
Yeah.
Kids are sitting down with it, and they can't put it down. I mean, they thought they knew. We sort of think we know poverty because we see it on TV, or we see it in our own city to a little degree, depending on where you live. And they just had no idea that things could be this bad. London in the 1830s, when Dickens started writing his novels, was a medieval city in many ways. And the slums, the overwhelming stench.
And the street children. Talk about the street children, how common they were in
so
London
common.
In those days.
You know, nobody ever was taking a census, so we don't know. In the year of 1850, New York City estimated it had 30,000 street children, because they did do a census that year. London didn't do that. I can easily use the figure of tens of thousands, but it's probably way understated. And a lot of these kids were orphans. Some of them were simply turned out by their parents. This happened all over the world. It still happens all over the world. Parents are alcoholic. There's no welfare system. There's nobody looking after these kids. There's no foster care system. And they end up on the streets.
And as you walk down the streets of London back in those days, they were
everywhere.
Everywhere.
In the shadows. In the shadows.
Almost hard to picture.
Hard to picture for us. I mean, we see the sort of nostalgic prints of the little flower girls, and you'd see some children at the markets, and you see the illustrations in Dickens' books of, in Oliver Twist, for example, when the Artful Dodger is teaching Oliver how to be a pickpocket. So you sort of have these images, but they were everywhere. And the challenge for me was to reconstruct London in that period of time and to make kids feel what that was like, to make them sense every bit of it. And so I do open the book there, and I open it with Dickens watching, because he walked sometimes 20 miles a day throughout the streets of London. This was a lifelong habit. This is where his story ideas came from. It's how he learned all these different dialects and made everything so realistic, because he wrote about what he saw in his essays and his novels.
You know, I think people today forget exactly what kind of impact Charles Dickens had in terms of how the popular view of poorer folks was back in those days. What impact did he have? Remind us of that.
It cannot be overstated. He was the lower classes considered him their spokesman. The upper classes adored him too, because he gave them such wonderful stories. And the overall thing that he did was that when people would read his books, what they didn't know was that Dickens was very subtly at work, sort of behind the scenes, getting them to do things he wanted them to do. And as a result of that, some of the worst slums were torn down. Many, many things happened. Dickens was an environmentalist before we knew that word, helping to clear up pollution in the air, helping to get medical care to slum children. He was very much a proponent for the ragged schools, which was a fledgling movement at the beginning of Dickens' career, to educate slum children, but he really felt that education was the key. He'd always known that in his own life, and he really believed it for the masses of the poor. And it comes through, you know, stories like A Christmas Carol. We think, oh, it's this wonderful ghost story, and we have this cranky old Scrooge, and by morning he's this wonderful person. There's so much more. There's so many things going on in that, so many themes, so many layers of what happens. And the reason that Dickens picked a ghost story to begin with, because the British were so fascinated with the paranormal, and so he thought they would read a story, not about one ghost, but about three ghosts. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But, you know, the warning that comes through when you see the spirit of Christmas present, and under the robes are the boy and the girl, ignorance and want. Some people will watch the play or read the book and pass right over that. And you ask them about it later and they don't even remember it. But once you understand what Dickens was doing with that little scene, now you really focus on it, because he was saying, this is your warning, Great Britain. You know, take care of the poor or they're going to rise up. The same thing that happened in France with the revolution is going to happen here.
You have a deep interest in the welfare of children. One of your previous books was about the orphan trains, these trains that would race across the Midwest, make various stops, and kids who were orphans would sort of get off and look for a new family. Where does this interest in kids and kids' welfare come from?
I have a daughter adopted from Vietnam during the war, and she would have probably become a street child if she'd survived long enough. She was orphaned by the war. She was in a terrible orphanage over there. And we worked through one of the American groups that was trying to help those children. And in Vietnam, if you have any kind of blood tie, it could be a great uncle twice removed or something, you would not be allowed to be adopted, even if you're in a terrible orphanage. But if you had nobody, if you were an abandoned child, then they could get you to a new home. Not in Vietnam, because not during that war, because the family system was so fractured there. So they were always looking for homes in the West.
Is this book available at the Johnson County Public Library, Dennis?
Yes, I've got my copy with me.
Yeah, yeah. Is it going off the shelves?
Yes, I had to put a hold on it to get it.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yes.
Yeah. How do kids react to it?
I haven't really spoken to any children directly about it.
Kate, Debbie, anybody?
I know that the critical reaction has been very, very positive.
Mm-hmm.
Andrea always writes so well, and her books are always well received. But, you know, she's gotten starred reviews and, you know, on best lists. And I think kids respond to her books as well, and that's part of the reason why, you know, she's on these lists. It's not just that the critics like her, but the kids like her as well.
Yeah.
And the teachers.
Yes, yes. The teachers, too.
Yes, that's important.
Very good. Well, Andrea Warren, thanks so much for coming in. Again, her book is Charles Dickens and the Street Children of London.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks so much, Andrea. You bet. Let's go to our list of great kids' books to consider for gift-giving this holiday season. We do that every year here on Up to Date with our Johnson County librarians. And Debbie, as you go out of the library business, what kind of year was it for kids' books?
It was really a pretty good year, I think. There's some really well-written stuff out there. There's you know, some trends that I see that's going on that or things are taking a little bit of a change, and I think it's a good thing.
A change how?
Well, what I'm seeing is there are some things that deal with supernatural beings, but there's a lot more books coming out where ordinary kids have special abilities or special powers. And there's more of those that I've seen coming out. And even for next year, I'm seeing more of that. I mean, angels are big now. And there's always going to be your vampires and your werewolves and your paranormal and dystopian and all that stuff. But, I'm seeing more where these kids are really taking it into their own and, you know, having these abilities that they're not sure that they have. And I think it reflects, you know, society in many ways, where you're not sure, you know, trying to find new talents when the talents that you've relied on, you know, they're no good anymore, or they're just not needed or whatever.
What's your special power, Debbie?
Oh, geez. I don't know, Steve. I'll come up with something.
After the show, tell me. Yeah.
Yes, I will.
Well, you have a book. Your first one here is for grades 4 and up. Its title is Wonderstruck, and it's by an author, Brian Selznick, who's sat in Kate Pickett's chair once upon a time.
Ooh, yeah. Kate.
I feel so honored.
Yeah. You are. Yeah, I love Brian. He's just a fantastic writer. And, of course, he was, you know, he did wonderful things with the invention of Hugo Cabret, which is now a film which everyone needs to go see.
Right.
And this is his second book. He wanted to do something totally different from Hugo Cabret. And Hugo Cabret, it's like the words and the pictures, you know, told the story one after the other. I mean, it continued. This book, the two stories are sort of parallel to one another, and they eventually converge. And it tells the story of Ben, whose mother has died, and he is struck deaf mm-hmm. in a lightning storm. That's the story that is done in print. And then there's the story of Rose, which takes place in the past, and it's all done with illustration until the two stories come together. And you see what the connection is and how they come together. And what's real interesting is, just like in Hugo, Brian has done a thing about film. He has a thing about film. It's in his family, as you know. And in this one, Rose is the daughter of a silent screen actress. And, you know, she's deaf, and her parents try to protect her from that, and how she feels, you know, like she's part of society when she can go into the movie theater because they are silent. And then talkies come in, and she's once again isolated. So it's really a very fascinating book, really well written, and it reads very, very fast.
So he lived up to the first book in some sense.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. And he's done something different, which is good, you know.
Yeah. Kate Pickett, let's move on to a book for middle and high school students. And by all means, if kids are out there listening to this show and want to make a recommendation for a good kids' book that they might recommend, this would be a great time to call. Our number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Kate Pickett, tell us about a book, Where Things Come Back.
Yes, this book is by John Corey Whaley, and it's set in a small town in Arkansas called Lily, where the town is all a Twitter because they've just had a report of a sighting of the Lazarus woodpecker, which was thought to be an extinct species.
Mm-hmm.
But the main character, Colin Witter, could not care less about this woodpecker. Just weeks after they see the sighting, his brother goes missing. And so while the whole town is celebrating the return of this woodpecker, there's bird enthusiasts and the media is there. Colin's trying to get over the loss of his brother and figure out what happened to him and how he's gone missing, if he's ever going to come back. It's an interesting look at a small town that was slowly dying. Businesses were closing. And now with the sighting of this bird, everybody's come to town. They've got the Lazarus burger, and his mom is a hairdresser and she gives Lazarus haircuts, where she gives him like a mohawk with a red fringe or something. It's a really interesting book from a debut author. And I think it's really fun to read the first book of an author. I have a feeling this book's going to win a lot of awards. It's been really well received by teens and by critics. And so I'm really excited to see what happens in January with the awards that are going to come out and what he's going to write next.
That book, again, is Where Things Come Back by John Corey Whaley, and very strong recommendation from Kate Pickett.
Yes.
Kate, thanks. Mm-hmm. Dennis Ross, how about a book for grades, kids roughly 5 to 9? The title of this book, The Chronicles of Harris Burdick, 14 Amazing Authors Tell the Tales.
Right. And I could have said, grade 5 to adult just as easily.
Okay.
In 1984, Chris Van Allsburg published a book with just 14 very enigmatic illustrations and captions. And, I mean, they're unusual. And ever since then, teachers and other people have been using those as story starters for creative writing lessons. Well, finally, they pulled in 14 of the best authors working and had each of them write a story inspired by one of the illustrations.
It's a neat idea.
Yeah.
A different kind of idea, right?
Oh, yeah. And, I wasn't sure when I first heard about it if I liked that idea, because I still like the idea of looking at these pictures and trying to imagine what the story is myself without having to hear somebody else's. But like I said, they are some of the very best authors, working anywhere.
Yeah.
The stories are entertaining.
That's great. Well, Jeremy Bernfeld from Harvest Public Media is going to read one of these selections for us. Jeremy?
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
So I want to read this passage here. This book is suspicious. The stories you find here may have been written, as so many Burdick stories have been written, as the guesswork of authors drawn to Mr. Burdick's striking images and captions. But I believe these are the actual stories written by Harris Burdick, given by Burdick to the various authors who are now pretending to have written them. I have no proof of this theory, but when I questioned the authors involved, their answers did nothing to change my mind. Sherman Alexie told me it was none of my business. Jules Pfeiffer told me it was none of my concern. Lois Lowry told me she'd never heard anything so ridiculous in all her life. Louis Sacker told me he'd heard something equally ridiculous, but that it was a very long time ago. Kate DiCamillo told me to talk to her lawyer. M.T. Anderson told me to talk to his doctor. Tabitha King told me to talk to her husband. Stephen King told me to talk to his wife. Cory Doctorow told me I should ask Walter Dean Myers, who told me to go bother Linda Sue Park, who directed me to Gregory Maguire, who told me that he had a special message from Chris Van Allsburg, which was to go away and leave him alone and stop talking about Harris Burdick. Finally, John Shiska told me that he would be happy to answer my questions and to please come in and have some ice cream. And then after a long pause, he fled through the window and left me alone, and it turned out to be sherbet. Perhaps it doesn't matter. Perhaps these stories were written by Harris Burdick, and perhaps they were not. Either way, the mysteries of Harris Burdick continue, and if you open this book, you will likely be mystified yourself. As you reread the stories, stare at the images, and ponder the mysteries of Harris Burdick, you will find yourself in a mystery that joins so many authors and readers together in breathless wonder.
That's Jeremy Bernfeld. Jeremy, thank you. And those are all the authors who made contributions.
That's most of them,
here,
yeah. This
Dennis.
Introduction was written by Lemony Snicket, who's also pretty well known.
I was going to say, Kate DeCamillo, there's some great contributors here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, again, that book is The Chronicles of Harris Burdick. Debbie, how about the book I Want My Hat Back? And I don't blame you for wanting it back.
Yeah, it's a little cooler. This is a story, or it's a picture book, and it's very much done in a minimalist style. And it tells the story of Bear, who is looking for his hat. And he goes through the forest and asks various animals if they have seen his hat. And as he goes through and he asks them all the questions, you know, have you seen it? They say no, no, no. And then you can see the light bulb going on. It's like, wait a minute, I noticed something. And readers, if they're being observant, they will see what Bear has sort of like overlooked. And it's a book that I think adults will enjoy reading to their kids. It's very short, and it's got a great sense of humor to it.
Again, that book is I Want My Hat Back by Jay Klassen.
Right.
Okay. And again, if you want to join our conversation this morning, perhaps you have a good recommendation for a good kids book that you'd want to tell others about, 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org. Let's go to Daniel from up in Smithville. Daniel, good morning.
Oh, hi. The Lives of Christopher Chant is a pretty great book. It's got a lot of fantasy in it and drama. And it's a nice book to read. And it's, you know, it's pretty suspenseful and stuff.
How old do you have to be, Daniel, to read a book like this?
Probably like, 11 or 12.
And what was your favorite part of it?
Probably the end where they're defending the castle.
Okay. And give me the full title of that book again, would you please?
The Lives of Christopher Chant.
Okay. Well, Daniel, happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Thanks for calling it in to us. I sure appreciate it.
Good choice, Daniel.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Very good choice.
Yeah, bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay, Kate, tell us about Across the Universe by Beth Rivas.
Yes, this is a great opportunity to escape Kansas City for space. This story takes place, the main character is Amy, and her story begins when she and her parents are cryogenically frozen on a mission to terraform another planet that they call Centauri Earth. That's about 300, it'll take them 300 years to get there. And so she's in the freezing process, and something goes wrong, and she's still conscious. She's aware for these hundreds of years, and she's thinking, and she's remembering what she's left behind on Earth, her friends, her family. And the other part of the story is a part of the caretakers of the ship. So it's traveling along its way for 300 years, and there's a whole other group of people whose job is to take care of the ship and these people who are cryogenically frozen. And the story gets really interesting when Amy is awoken prematurely by about 50 years by a saboteur who is slowly unfreezing people. And so she and the future leader of the ship, whose name is Elder, are going to try and figure out who's doing this and protect her parents from being unfrozen.
So when you're being unfrozen, Kate, how cold are you at that point in your existence?
She's very cold,
she's
in a coffin that's basically, it's a glass coffin filled with water, and so she's actually almost drowning in it. She can't get out, and Elder is the one who finds her and rescues her from dying slowly in this glass coffin.
My goodness. Well, Peggy Lowe from Harvest Public Media has a little excerpt from this book she's going to read. Good morning, Peggy.
Good morning. There was a click, click, grr of gears, and I knew the flash freezing would start in mere moments, and then my life would be nothing but a puff of white steam leaking through the cracks of my morgue door. And I thought, at least I'll sleep. I will forget for 301 years everything else. And then I thought, that will be nice. And then, whoosh, the flash freeze filled the tiny chamber. I was in ice. I was ice. I am ice. But if I'm ice, how am I conscious? I was supposed to be asleep. I was supposed to forget about Jason and life and Earth for 301 years. People have been chiro-frozen before me, and none of them were conscious. If the mind is frozen, it cannot be awake or aware. I've read before of coma victims who were supposed to be knocked out with anesthesia during an operation, but really they were awake and felt everything. I hope, I pray, that's not me. I can't be awake for 301 years. I'll never survive that. Maybe I'm dreaming now. I've dreamt a lifetime in a 30-minute nap. Maybe I'm still in that space between frozen and not, and this is all a dream. Maybe we haven't left Earth yet. Maybe I'm still in that limbo year before the ship launches and I'm stuck, trapped in a dream I can't wake from.
Man, what an idea for a book to be like, you know, to be being frozen for 300 years and then it doesn't work. What an idea.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating the dichotomy between what she remembers of what would now be current Earth and what elder 250 years in the future. It's almost like time travel. So
yeah.
It's very interesting.
That book, again, Across the Universe by Beth Rivas. Again, we'll put all these books up on our website, kcur.org. Dennis Ross, tell us about Guys Read Funny Business.
This is another compilation of stories put together by John Sheska, who is also the founder of the website guysread.com. And his mission in life is to write and produce stories that guys will want to read and make it easy for them to find them. So his website is all about that. And this is one of a group of books. There's one called Guys Read Thriller. That's another compilation of stories by different authors. This one is Funny Business, so you can imagine they're humorous stories. And it's got stories by Ewan Colfer and Christopher Paul Curtis and John Sheska himself and Jack Gantos and Kate DiCamillo, again, who's the only woman writing in this.
She is prolific just everywhere.
She's
good. She's been here before.
The short selection that we've chosen for a read aloud is by David Lubar, who's another really funny writer.
We took Kate DiCamillo a couple of years ago over to Westwood View Elementary School.
Oh, wow.
And we did the show live from there. And it was just a blast. The kids just absolutely loved her. And what do we know about young boys reading these days? How big an issue is it, Dennis?
Well, it depends on which magazine article you read.
Yeah, right.
Some people think it's a really big issue, and some people think that it's just that other adults are looking at it backwards. A lot of people seem to think that guys don't read as much as they should, and other people say that you're just not offering them the right kinds of things.
Right.
You know, give them some nonfiction or, you know, just realize that they are different from girls and go with it. So, I see a lot of guys in my library every day, and they're checking out books.
Well, Steven Steigman, our up-to-date producer, who has a young son himself, who hopefully will be reading before too long, is about to read a little book excerpt here from Guys Read Funny Business.
This is called Kid Appeal. Dwight Hautzer is an idiot. He's also my best friend. Brains aren't all that important most of the time, and they're definitely not the first thing I look for when I pick my friends. For example, Zeke Walther, that motormouth show-off, is super smart, but I'd never want to hang out with him. There are lots of other things that make someone a great best friend, like loyalty and courage. Dwight's totally loyal. He'd never tell on me, no matter what I did. Even though he got 6 weeks of detention, Dwight never admitted he had helped when he dumped 20 packets of cherry Kool-Aid into the school's new fish pond. I swear we thought there weren't any fish in it yet. I guess it's a good thing only two of them were hiding in there and at that time. They looked really pretty right before they turned belly up. It was sort of like a Dr. Seuss story. One fish, two fish, red fish, dead fish. And to this day, nobody who could punish me for it has a clue I was with Dwight when we snuck into the principal's office and replaced the regular CD of the national anthem with the one where the whole song was burped. At least he only got 1 week of detention for that. As for courage, I know Dwight would stand right next to me if I got attacked by a band of ninjas or a pack of zombies. If I got bitten by a snake, I bet he'd even suck out the poison. As long as I got bitten on the leg or the arm. If I got bitten in the butt, I'd understand if he let me die.
That's Stephen Steigman reading from Guys Read Funny Business for Grades, what, 5 through 8, Dennis?
Yes, I'd say so, yeah.
Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with our Johnson County librarians who are offering us some good recommendations for good kids' books this holiday season. And we'll take your phone calls, too, your recommendations. If you're a kid and have a good recommendation for other kids, we want to hear from you. 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's look at the biggest religion news stories of the year, you'll find it on our website, kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, a psychologist explains the tension that can result from teens and college students home for the holidays. Imagine that, a little tension in the house. Plus, Brian McTavish returns with our holiday weekend to-do list. This hour, we're visiting with our Johnson County librarian friends about some great kids' books from 2011. We're visiting with Debbie McLeod, Kate Pickett, and Dennis Ross. And next up here, Debbie, is a book, Close to Famous. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is a book by Joan Bauer, and she usually writes books for older kids. So she decided to go for a little younger audience. And this tells the story of Foster McGee, who, with her mother, they're fleeing Memphis from her mother's abusive boyfriend, who happens to be an Elvis impersonator. Yes.
Okay.
So there's a lot of interesting things in this book. But Foster is an aspiring pastry chef. And she is known for her muffins and her cupcakes. And her plan is to have her own restaurant and to write her own cookbook and eventually have her own celebrity cooking show.
At age 12, she's already an aspiring pastry chef.
Yes, she is.
My goodness. Okay.
Yes. And the section we're going to start off with is when they are leaving Memphis, and Foster recounts how she became into baking.
Ah. Well, KCUR's Nancy Cacamo is going to read a little bit from Close to Famous. Nancy?
I grab a chocolate chip muffin from my Bake and Take carrier and take a bite. It's chewy from the touch of corn flour I used. I learned to make muffins from Marietta Morningstar, the muffin queen of Memphis. Mama says you can't just wait for things to happen. You've got to get out there and make your own breaks. So I showed up at Marietta's shop. I'm going to have my own restaurant someday, I told her, and I was wondering if I could help you in your kitchen. I'll do anything at all, and you don't have to pay me. I just want to learn. She looked at me kind of strange, which I was expecting. I said, I'll thank you in my cookbook when it comes out, and I promise I won't steal even one of your recipes. And who might you be, young lady? I'm Foster McPhee, ma'am. I got an easy bake oven when I was 4, and the rest is history. She was paying attention now. In case you're wondering, my mother knows I'm here. She's pretty bad in the kitchen and the worst baker ever. I'm looking for cooking role models. Marietta Morningstar studied me like I was a recipe. You know more about muffins than any person in the world, probably. But I figure you had to start somewhere. She smiled. I walked up and down the streets of Memphis, passing out free samples. People wanted more. I reached into my bag and pulled out a pumpkin spice muffin with walnuts that was as moist as anything. It can be plain for breakfast, or I can top it with cream cheese frosting. I like a muffin that can go from day to evening. I gave it to her. She sniffed it, nodded, and held it up. How do I know you're not trying to poison me? I wasn't expecting that question. Ms. Morningstar, I swear, if I was going to poison you, I wouldn't ruin a perfectly fine muffin to do it.
That's Nancy Cacamo. Nancy, thank you very much. Again, that book, Close to Famous for Grades, what, 5 to 8?
Debbie? Yeah, though I think a fourth grader, you know, would be fine with it as well.
That sounds like a pretty fun book.
It is. Okay.
Joan Bauer is one of those authors that just can't help being funny.
Yeah. Right.
She just, even without trying, hardly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's great.
Well, Kate Pickett, you're back with an oldie but goodie, True Grit.
Yes. My dad was a big fan of the old John Wayne film when I was a kid, so I watched that several times. And when the new movie was coming out, I was really surprised to find out I'd never known that it was based on a book by Charles Portis. And so I picked up the book, and it is fabulous. It's a great read, I think, for any like middle schooler or high schooler, for the whole family to read and maybe watch the new movie with Jeff Bridges and discuss. It's the story of 14-year-old Maddie Ross, who has traveled on her own to Fort Smith to find her father's killer, Tom Chaney, who killed his dad in
and
a
she's
drunken
she's a pistol,
stupor.
Right?
Oh, I love Maddie. She is one of my new favorite characters. She hires this crotchety old U.S. Marshal, Rooster Cogburn, because they say that he's got grit and he's the toughest marshal there is, to hunt down Tom Chaney in the Indian Territory. And along the way, they meet a Texas Ranger named LaBeef, who joins them as well. Maddie is just absolutely a fabulous character. My favorite part is when she sits down. They've cornered two criminals in a hut in the woods in the middle of the night, and they're talking to him, and Rooster's trying to get information out of him. And Maddie says, "Well, if you help Rooster, I'll have my lawyer help you, and he can get you a good one." And one of the criminals says, "I don't even like you. What are you doing here?" And she says, "I don't like you either. My lawyer isn't going to help you." Just, you know, a 14-year-old girl sassing a person who's probably killed a dozen people, telling him that her lawyer isn't going to help him out in court. I just love her character. And it's such a great story for everybody. It just caught my heart up.
Is the latest version of True Grit on the big screen better than the original version with John Wayne?
Well, yeah, it's more true to the book. That's
oh, is that right?
Yes, yeah. The new movie seems almost like they just took the book and turned it into a script without changing a thing. It's absolutely a great example of an adaptation from a book into a movie. Yeah.
That's True Grit by Charles Portis, and that would be for middle and high school
Yeah,
kids?
And adults. You can read it as the whole family. I think it'd be great on a snowy evening over winter break to read the book, watch the movie, and
Sounds
discuss
to
it
me.
Together.
Oh, that's a neat idea. Yeah. Very good idea. Susan writes us this at UpToDate@KCUR.org. What is the age range for Wonderstruck? I want to give it as a gift to my 8-year-old nephew, Debbie.
Oh, perfect. You know, I think even he should be able to handle the vocabulary in there, but I think 8-year-olds would be just fine, 8 to 12, and even older than that.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much in that book, and just to look at the craftsmanship that Brian does when he does these books is just amazing. So.
Yeah.
And I always tell my teens, because I always give them those books. I've given them Wonderstruck, and I've given them Hugo Cabret, and I say, you take this on winter break with you, and, you know, your parents are always like, oh, do your laundry, clean your room, you know, do this stuff. And if you go, Mom, I spent all day reading this huge book. I have accomplished a lot. They'll leave you alone, and they don't ever need to know that there are hundreds of pictures in there, too.
Lots of brownie points to
yes,
be had there,
exactly.
Right? Kathy from Kansas City writes this, my daughter reads at a third grade level and a chapter book, but is 6 years old and in first grade. I struggle to know what to choose for her to try. The bookstores group third to sixth grade together. I tend to try to get those books, but then worry that the subject matter is for much older children. What are your suggestions or thoughts?
Magic's Treehouse are always really good books.
Mm-hmm.
Kids have really liked those.
Yeah, we
and
went
it's a
through
series.
Some of those.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, Junie B. Jones, that's always good too.
Oh, that's a great one.
You know, Junie is still around. Doreen Cronin is coming out with a new series, and I cannot think of the name of it at this time, but it deals with a rescue dog and how he is retired and he lives on a farm. And he's looking after these missing chickens, and it's the first book in a series, and it's really pretty good. So just go to your library, look for Doreen Cronin, yeah. And, you know, very good for third graders.
That sounds like the Hank the Cow Dog series,
it
too,
is.
Which
it's,
is also good
yeah.
for this woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mary from Shawnee. Mary, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, okay. I'm calling about the What to Expect series by Bridget Hios.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
What to Expect if You're Expecting Marsupial
right.
is the latest. And then there were larvae. They're very cute.
Right. She did the silkworm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the Stephen Jorish is the illustrator who illustrated Jabberwocky, and the illustrations are really
And those books are for what age, Mary?
I would say I read it to my almost two-year-old yesterday, and he jumped down after half of it. So I'd say probably more like five, because there's a lot of a lot of learning in it. Probably 5 to 9.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mary. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
You too. Bye bye.
Tricia writes this. Is this Tricia from the Johnson County Public Library?
Could be.
I imagine
Solo
so.
Trop? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd recommend these two wonderful books for teens, adults, Marcello in the Real World by Francisco X. Stork.
Yes.
Marcello Sandoval hears music that nobody else can hear, part of an autism-like condition that no doctor has been able to identify. But his father has never fully believed in the music or Marcello's differences, and he challenges Marcello to work in the mailroom of his law firm for the summer to join the real world. She also recommends a picture book for all ages, Duck Rabbit by Amy
yes.
Krauss-Rosenthal.
It's a rabbit.
Yes, it's a rabbit.
It's a
yes.
rabbit.
Yeah, it's a rabbit.
That's the title? Is It's a Rabbit?
No, it's called Duck Rabbit. And it's a book on perspective, and depending on how you see it, Dennis has it.
Oh, Dennis has it.
Yeah.
Here.
Is that a duck or a rabbit,
a duck
Steve?
Or a rabbit,
it's a clever
Steve.
Take on the age-old optical illusion. Is it a duck or a rabbit?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Duck or rabbit?
Show it to me again. Is it a duck or a rabbit? It's a rabbit. It's a rabbit. Do you disagree?
Oh, it's definitely a
looking
rabbit.
Looking at the cover illustration, which has two very long ears, and it makes it look like it's a rabbit, not a duck. Okay.
All right.
But you like that book. And
yes,
Tricia
I do.
Liked that book.
I like that one a lot, yes.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Dennis Ross, you're up next for a book, The Name of the Star by Maureen Johnson. This is for grades 8 through senior in high school, roughly.
Yes, and Maureen Johnson is personally one of my favorite authors, and she's another one of those who can't help being funny, and usually she's trying to be funny. This is a departure for her. It's a murder mystery set in London. There's a girl named Rory who's from Louisiana, and she's just gone to London to go to a boarding school there, and in the part of London where the Jack the Ripper murders took place over 100 years earlier, well, people start dying in a very similar manner in this neighborhood. And this girl gets caught up in kind of a ghost story mystery.
How did Jack the Ripper kill? Can I ask?
With a scalpel.
Just sort of cross sharp
the
implement of some
neck,
kind.
Eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's a ghost story and a murder mystery, and it was one of my favorite teen books of the year.
Okay, that book again, The Name of the Star by Maureen Johnson. Debbie McLeod, tell us about Ragin', Jazzin', Rockin' American Musical Instrument Makers.
Oh, this is a fascinating book, and it's a perfect gift for anyone who has a musician in their family.
Mm.
And it gives short biographies of people whose names are identified with certain instruments.
Ah, neat idea.
And while it might not be, you know, the person didn't invent it, you know, Fender, you know, did the electric guitars and, you know, the Hammond organs. I mean, things that when you think of an instrument, you know, Steinway pianos, you know, the top of the line, you know, where it all came from and how they improved the product. And then you've got Moog. I mean, that really was his last name. And he created the Moog synthesizer.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, you know. And it's really fascinating. It's got period photos. It's written in a very conversational style. It's got nice graphics in it. I think it would be like the perfect gift for, you know, someone who's into music and wants to know. And they're interesting, just little tidbits of information about how these products came to be.
Now, just when you think every great idea for a kid's book has been exhausted, then you hear about something like that, and you're like, what a neat idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Kate, how about Anya's Ghost?
Yes, this is by Vera Broskull, and I wanted to throw in one graphic novel. So this is a fabulous story about Anya, who she's a Russian immigrant who really doesn't like her Russian past. Her mom's always cooking these traditional Russian dishes for her and trying to get her to go to their Orthodox church, and she doesn't like to be a part of that. She thinks it sets her apart from being a teenager. She feels like she gets made fun of at school. And one day after school, she falls down a well and discovers a dead body down there that's haunted by a ghost. And the ghost, after she's rescued out of the well, the ghost follows her and learns about society and asks all these questions about why Anya's different and why she doesn't like to be different. And the two of them form this friendship, and the ghost tries to help Anya to fit into society. And through that, Anya kind of finds out about the value of her traditional community and her Russian heritage. So it's a really great story. It's beautifully drawn, all in these shades of gray. It's just a great story about finding that spot where you fit in and trying to be more comfortable with who you are.
Anya's Ghost by Vera Broskal?
I think so.
I'm close, probably. Okay.
Sounds good.
Again, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're running through a whole and very good list of children's books that might make great holiday time gifts for kids in your family or nearby. If you have a recommendation, if you're a kid yourself and want to recommend something to our listening audience, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Dennis Ross, how about the masterwork of a painting elephant?
Yes.
Do tell. Elephants can paint.
This one can, yes. He's a white elephant, too. This is by Michelle Cuevas. It was recommended to me by my friend Deb Pettit, and she's usually right when she says something's wonderful. When I finished this, I just said, that is just a little gem. It just has this beautiful writing. So even though it's suitable for grades 4 and up, there's a lot of adult appeal because the writing is just really, really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It's about this little boy named Pigeon who was abandoned as a baby, and the elephant's name is Birch, who was a former circus elephant, and he adopts Pigeon and carries him around on his back, and he paints wonderful paintings as well. And that's a very confusing description of a very pretty book.
Masterwork of a Painting Elephant. Yeah, what a great title here. W. McLeod, True Blue, not True Grit, True Blue. Lots of true stuff.
Yeah, we have lots of trues, yes.
This is a Jane Smiley book.
Right. This is the third book that she's done about Abby Lovett and her family. And this tells the story of Abby gets this horse whose owner has died, and she believes that the horse is haunted by its previous owner.
Mm. And it's just that simple.
It's just that simple, and how she just learns to cope with it. And the section that we're going to read is how she comes to get Blue.
And guess who's going to read a little excerpt from here? Our friend Danny Alexander from the UpToDate staff here at KCUR. Danny, good morning.
Good morning. I was really glad to get this because it kind of reminded me when I got my first horse.
Yay, horses.
I know. So it's really fun to go ahead and read this.
Please do.
I will. She and Daddy stared at each other, but I knew there wasn't any disagreement, really. True Blue was a gorgeous horse with a perfect head and a big, kind eye. The only thing holding Daddy back was that superstition about gift horses. I put my hand in my pocket. There was a dollar there, along with some coins. I took my hand out of my pocket and held it toward Jane. She held out her hand, and I dropped the money into it. Turned out the dollar was a $5 bill, and the coins were 2 quarters and a dime. Jane looked at the money, then smiled. She said, "Well, Miss Abby, you beat out the other bidder, and now you've got yourself a horse." Mom stepped up to him and patted him and said, "He seems very sweet." Daddy pretended to be scowling. Then he said, "I'll give you 10." And Jane laughed and said, "Sorry, sir, the bidding has closed." I still had True Blue's rope in my hand, so I led him over to a patch of grass and let him graze. I could see Daddy and Jane keep talking. I petted Blue again, this time along his shoulder and flanks. I knew we were playing a game and that Daddy would have taken Blue. He was sound and nice, and no reason not to. But even so, I felt like I had bought myself a horse, and it was a wonderfully scary feeling.
You're smiling as you read that. You can relate to that. That's Danny Alexander from True Blue by Jane Smalley here. Let's go to Rachel from Olathe. Rachel, welcome to the show. Rachel, good morning.
Hi, guys. Great show. Thanks for talking about this. Reading was one of the best things that ever happened to me as a kid and as an adult.
Good.
Yeah. So the two books I wanted to recommend, one from my early childhood and one from a little bit later, was one's The Phantom Tollbooth, and your producer looked up the author. I think it's Norman Justice.
Yes.
The other is The Westing Game by Ellen Raskin. Mm-hmm. So highly recommend both of those to young readers.
Oh, thank you very much, Rachel. Great picks.
Thank you.
We're getting lots of nodding heads here in the studio.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Kate Pickett, The Sky is Everywhere, a book for high schoolers.
Yes, this is a kind of sad, melancholy romance story by Jandy Nelson about Lenny, who's named after John Lennon. Her parents are kind of ex-hippies, whose sister dies unexpectedly during play practice. And Lenny is left with this hole in her life, who she fills with two boys who she falls in love with, a new one to school who's a musician and he's very exciting, and an old one who happens to be her sister's boyfriend. And so there's this kind of crazy love triangle going on all the time. Lenny's trying to figure out who she is without her sister.
Okay. That book, again, The Sky is Everywhere. If you go to our website, kcur.org, you'll find lots of links on the up-to-date page for all the books we're talking about here today. Dennis, A Ball for Daisy.
Right. A Ball for Daisy is my favorite picture book that I've seen so far this year.
Wow.
It's a wordless picture book also. It's by Chris Roschka, who has at least one Caldecott medal to his name, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Already. He also illustrated another one of my favorite picture books this year, Fortune Cookies,
yes,
by a local author.
And what you like about this one?
Just the facial expressions on this dog are just so expressive. He doesn't need words.
You're showing me. Are those watercolors?
Yes,
maybe, I think so. Uh-huh.
And beautiful. Yeah.
He loves his ball.
Greens,
she loves
and
her
oranges.
Ball. And,
yeah,
and then something happens to her ball, and then she's so sad, and then someone comes along later and makes her happy again. It's just he just can do so much with a few watercolor lines.
Yeah, he's excellent. Yeah.
That's great. A Ball for Daisy by Chris Roschka. Okay. Debbie, you will be my friend.
Well,
yes,
and
you
this
are.
Is something totally opposite. That tells the, it's the second book about Lucy, who is an overenthusiastic bear. And she's decided she is going to get a friend. And she goes up to everybody and says, "You will be my friend."
Yeah.
And just very frantic, very, you know, excited. And everyone's like, "Oh, my God, let's get away from her." And just a fun, fun book.
You Will Be My Friend by Debbie McLeod. And boy, where did this hour go? It went by awfully quickly. Well, thank you all for coming in.
Always
so
does,
good
yes.
to have you guys here.
It's
happy
fun
holidays.
To be here.
Yeah.
Happy holidays to you.
Happy retirement, Debbie.
Oh, thanks,
you
Steve.
Earned it. I wish you all the best. Yeah.
Thanks.
Our thanks to our Johnson County librarians, Debbie McLeod, Kate Pickett, and Dennis Ross. Again, you'll find a link to their best of 2011 lists as well as older broadcasts and podcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow this program on Facebook and Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. And be sure to join us tomorrow as a psychologist explains the tension that can result from teens and college students home for the holidays. Plus, Brian McTavish returns with the weekend to-do list. Our theme music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Danny Alexander, Maria Carter, and Suzanne Hogan. The show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.